You're listening to The Dead Prussian, a podcast about war and warfare.
Regular listeners will know that we like to talk about the causes of war on this show. In fact, we've had an episode called The Causes of War. We've seen arguments from some pretty esteemed academics on the fact that war is in decline, that peace is on the rise. And we've also had other, I would say, nearly more esteemed, if you could esteem your academics at different levels, on how some of the data used to measure that may not necessarily be as correct or as rigorous as expected. Now, that's not to call former guests into question, because I generally do that when they're on the show. But what it means is I need to explore more about the causes of war and why we fight for you listeners. G'day, listeners, and welcome to the Dead Prussian podcast. I'm your host, your humblest host, actually, with a show named after a Prussian military theorist from the 19th century, the original Dead Prussian. Not of all Dead Prussians, but the original one that we all like to refer to. Thanks for the iTunes reviews. To the fellow that gave me the three-star review and said, cut out the intros, this one's going to be an extra long one for you. So thanks very much for that. The US listener, you've done really, really well in motivating me to keep talking just to myself. Anyway, listeners, we're going to start going on with the show because I don't really want to alienate the rest of my audience just for a three-star review because it's better than the one-star review I got about mouth noises. My guest today is Dr. Mike Martin. He's a former British Army officer who has worked, travelled and lived all over the world in order to try and understand conflict. His previous books include A Brief History of Helmand and An Intimate War, An Oral History of the Helmand Conflict. He's crossing the Congo over land and water in a hard place. That's very descriptive. Was shortlisted for the Edward Stanford Travel Writing Award 2016 in the category of Adventure Travel. He's educated in biology and conflict. That's a new combo for you, listeners. And he is a War Studies Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London. Mike, thanks for appearing on the show.
Hey, Mick, how are you doing?
I am good. How are you?
Very good. Thanks very much.
Now, before we get into the details of our topic today, I'm keen to know, as I'm sure most of my listeners are, especially with the biology and conflict background, how you ended up as an academic studying conflict?
Well, basically, I think I'd always wanted to be in the army ever since I was a kid. I'm sure many of your listeners have the same kind of thing. And so I had all the magazines and, you know, I was obsessed with World War II or whatever it was. Went to uni, that was the biology bit. And then after a bit of living in different places around the world, joined the army. And joined the army on a particular path. So I learned Pashto, which was the language in Afghanistan, and then spent a couple of years in Afghanistan. And then after that process, I ended up writing a PhD about the conflict in Helmand, which the British Army paid for, which was very good of them. And that's where it started. That's where it began.
It's interesting that, you know, you've written a PhD on an area where you've lived and I suppose studied some of the aspects. Well, I guess most academics like to try and get some real world research done, but we have a lot of historians on the show that don't actually get the chance to do that in-depth field research because most of the people they study are dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this was living history, right? And the book about the conflict went from 1978 to 2012.
Yeah.
So from when they had the communist revolution in Afghanistan, the Russians invaded shortly after, up to 2012, which was kind of, that was when I really left.
Yeah.
Afghanistan, stopped serving in Afghanistan. And so the people I was speaking to or I was interviewing were, you know, they were regaling me with their life stories. And there was no written history in Helmand because, you know, literacy is for men is 8%, for women is about 0.5%.
Yeah.
So there is no chance to study written history about a place like Helmand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure many of the stories you collected actually spoke of a very good Australian, a very good looking Australian, in fact, kicking around there around 2010, 2011. But having visited the place, it's amazing the depth of oral knowledge. I remember someone telling me about Alexander, and they meant Alexander the Great.
And for them it was yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. And it was, you know, he was illiterate, but he could tell me, and the descriptions and stuff. Well, it was probably more accurate knowledge than I had of Alexander's Bactrian campaigns. So,
So obviously the British had been in Helmand before, and in the 1800s, you know, when we did our expeditions into Afghanistan, we always put something in Helmand, and we'd forgotten that, but the Helmandis had remembered it. Mm. And when we turned up in 2006, they assumed that we were going back to enact revenge on them for various battles that we'd fought in the 1880s.
Yeah.
And to them, it was my grandfather was in that battle. You know, the old people in Helmand in the early 2000s, the old, the 70-year-olds, their grandparents had fought us in the 1880s.
Yeah.
And we'd forgotten that, and they remembered it like it was yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah, Battle of Maiwand, places like that. Like,
exactly.
Very interesting and different, I guess, confronting for particularly what, you know, the Western military is a kind of tourist in some of these conflict zones.
Yeah.
Now, you recently wrote a book that is not about Helmand Province, before we just sit there and reminisce on that. Your new book is about why we fight as people, as humans, which is very interesting. What sort of drove you to write this book?
So it's I'm really trying to bring together all these different bits of my life. So I, you know, as we've already said, I wanted to join the army and then ended up fighting Afghanistan and studied biology at uni and then did a PhD about conflict. And I was just trying to bring all these things together. And the main motivator, and it'd be interesting if some of your listeners also twig this, is the lived experience of fighting. So getting in firefights or being excited about going to war. That's totally different to the way most people write about war. So social scientists, political scientists will talk about, you know, religion being the reason we fight, or, you know, ideology, or we're fighting in defense of our values. And in the media, there's a narrative, certainly in the UK, that, you know, the soldiers are fighting, poor them, they're there doing their duty, defending us and all that kind of stuff. Most of the soldiers I knew, officers and soldiers, wanted to be there. Almost the vast majority of them wanted to be there. They're excited. It was a sort of, they wanted to prove themselves, or they wanted to, you know, they were proud of being British or whatever. You know, so they were very positively motivated towards going there. So for me, that dissonance between what the lived experience of war was versus how most people wrote about it and spoke about it, I thought was odd. So I thought I'd explore that, and I ended up doing that through bringing together my experiences, my knowledge of evolutionary biology and psychology, and then my, you know, my PhD into conflict.
Which is it's an interesting point for our listeners to understand. The previous discussions we've had on the show, they have touched a bit more upon what we'd call the anthropological aspects of the causes of war, which is very different from some of our strategy-focused academics and history-focused academics we have on the show. Mm-hmm. But yours goes a bit deeper, because it's not just, you know, the difference between a Stone Age culture and the difference between, you know, Western culture these days. But you challenge some of those underlying aspects of culture itself. So you challenge standard explanations for conflict, such as morality, ideology, and religion, as you just mentioned. Now, why don't these hold up to scrutiny, these causes?
So, okay, this is the Dead Prussian podcast, right?
Yeah.
And so we got to start with a Clausewitzian element. So Clausewitz was big on talking about the essence of war, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't the first theorist to comment on the sort of unifying nature of war.
No, just the best looking
as a phenomenon. But he was, you know, he was big on that. And so if there's a unifying nature of war, it also implies that the causes, if you like, of war are unitary. There's not going to be a bunch of disparate causes.
Yeah.
Like, it can't be about resources and religion and, you know, it's got to be, like, what are these things? What's that? And to me, after a while, I stumbled upon the notion that unifying principle, that essence, it's got to derive from human psychology.
Yeah.
Because that's the ultimately, when you're trying to fight in a war, you're trying to have an effect on the opposing commander, right? You might, you know, launch a deception operation, or you might attack him straight up the middle, or you might, you know, take his allies out or whatever. But ultimately, you're trying to have an effect on his psychology.
Yeah.
Now, that's a roundabout way. But to come back to your question about, you know, specifically you asked me about moral codes, religions, and ideologies.
Yeah.
The thing about those is, if you look at their purpose in biology and in psychology, what those three things are trying to do is build bigger and bigger groups of humans.
Yeah.
So moral codes, religions, ideologies are basically like the rules of your group. Okay. Yeah. Whether you feel something's right or wrong is whether you've contravened a group norm. Whether something is said to be, you know, amoral in a religious sense, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
And ideology is the same. You know, we're trying to, whether it's democracy or communism, we're trying to solve problems of social coordination and build bigger groups.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned in your intro, we've had this sort of decline of violence over macro-historical time. You know, Pinker popularized that. People do question the data. I'm a strong advocate of that view.
Yeah.
The data is difficult, but generally, I absolutely am behind that view.
Yeah.
But the other trend is, whilst violence has declined, group sizes have gone up.
Yeah.
If you think about it, we live in mega societies now, yeah. Whereas previously we lived in bands of 30, then tribes, then chieftainships, then, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so whilst one hasn't driven the other, these two processes have happened at the same time. And so the religions, you know, religions, moral codes, and ideologies that help us build bigger groups actually reduce levels of violence, if you look at it over the macro term, because they're helping us to build bigger groups. And those bigger groups ultimately mean lower levels of violence, because a group is, if you think about it, is a non-violent collection of people living together. If they were fighting, they wouldn't be able to exist in a group.
That's all extremely deeper than extremely deeper. That's how I speak, listeners. But that is quite deep in terms of where I guess people assume those things to go. I mean, so basically, you're arguing that in fact the fact is that a lot of people usually hold responsible for violence. Their very psychological function, and I suppose sociological function, is to avoid violence, to ensure larger groups are formed, and to by maintaining a guideline for operating within collective groups. Is that where you're going?
Mm. So basically, let's go back to what it is that I think causes us to fight, right?
Yeah. Why do we
fight? And exactly. And so that is, I argue, that's because, and this is mostly men I'm talking about. And the reason I'm mostly talking about men is because that's what the data tell us.
Yeah.
On average, men are much more violent than women.
Yeah.
95% of murders are committed by men.
Yeah.
I mean, men look at armies, men fight in wars. And so this isn't the result of an invisible patriarchy. This is the result of differences between men and women that is in part determined by their differing biologies.
Mm.
And men pursue status more than women on average, okay? And the reason they do that is because in evolutionary history, men with higher status got more women. And that's the whole point of evolution, is to have more kids, to survive and to reproduce.
Yeah.
So men pursue status, and that's why they end up fighting. And if you look at murders, about 80% of murders worldwide are caused by what are called trivial altercations. So basically, people having fights over games of darts,
yeah,
pool games, glassing each other, you looked at my bird, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Trivial altercations. And those are basically status disputes. Those are you are getting in my face, who are you? And people are jostling in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And the reason people jostle in the hierarchy is because the rule of thumb is, if you're at the bottom of the hierarchy, you're unlikely to get a woman because the men at the top get the women. So if you're at the bottom of the hierarchy, jostle and get higher up in the hierarchy so you can get a man, so you can get a woman. So that's what drives, that's one of the things that drives men to fight, is the pursuit of status.
Yeah.
But because of that, you can't form groups because everyone's always fighting. So we've evolved a counteracting trend, which is to seek to belong to groups, because groups are non-violent. So whilst we're driven to status to try and find more mates, we're also driven to try and belong to groups, because groups are full of mates and they're safe because they're non-violent. So I can pursue my other evolutionary goals in a safe place where I'm not being attacked.
Yep.
So that's what causes people to fight. They're driven to seek status and they're driven to seek belonging.
Yeah. Interesting. The status thing about, males getting a higher status to attract a greater females, that probably explains why my female listener count is so low. But don't worry, listeners, we're working on it. It's interesting the way that I suppose you've approached the argument, because you've left room for inclusion in that I'll call it the pinker cannon. Now people will hear me say pinker cannon and they're like, oh, you can shoot stuff. But you got Pinker, Morris, and Gatt now that are writing about the data that. And it kind of links, although I do like that Ian Morris wrote about bonobo chimps versus the other type of chimpanzee and the way they go to war. That's completely inconsequential to our conversation today, though. So I guess when we're talking about what propels people into conflict, propels people into conflict, I think it's on the blurb on your book. I just thought that's a really good phrase. I'm going to steal it. So it's not really caused by ideas and values as discussed. And I guess this leads to your biological roots, not your individual as a human biological roots, because they're obviously from the British Isles. But people are propelled by almost at the subconscious level. So you talked about before.
Precisely. It's emotional, it's intuitive, it's subconscious. You don't think about these. Like, nobody thinks about murdering someone. You just feel insulted and you feel a rage and then you kill them.
Yeah.
But what's actually happening is you're fighting over status.
Yeah, do not tell the crime drama production machine about people don't think about murdering, because then we'll get all the clever plot lines. Like Broadchurch, cancelled. So
obviously some people do, but vast majority of murders are emotional, intuitive, unthought out, responses to situations.
And that's the door left open for the BBC there. But it's at the subconscious level. I guess this hones back to your original point, where you talked about the difference and the distance between why we go to war and why people fight it. Because there is a difference between why a politician will make a decision to go to war and a soldier who may be there because his mates are there, or his muckers for the British audience. He's fighting for the person next to him. These days, him or her. Whereas the politician, makes the decision based on strategic necessity and political ends. But this is my question. Is that politician's decision also underpinned largely by their own subconscious psychological drive for status or something like that?
Yes. Yeah. I was just about, as you were saying your question, I was just about to say, hang on, let's pick into what that strategic stuff is.
It takes me a while.
No, but of course that's obviously driven by psychology as well, right?
Yeah.
Very briefly, what's happening, just to link these two big ideas, because we've got this one idea, which is you've got the subconscious that drives you, and that drives you to seek status and seek belonging, right?
Yeah.
And then we've got this other idea, which is you've got religion and morals and ideologies, and they help you form bigger groups, right? And they lower levels of violence.
Yeah.
But the other thing is how your brain works, the relationship between your subconscious and your conscious.
Yeah.
Basically, what happens is your subconscious makes decisions slightly before your conscious brain does. And what your conscious brain does is it comes along slightly later and explains your subconscious desires to other people or to yourself. Okay. So it socially justifies what your subconscious desires are.
Yeah.
So when we're driven to fight because of status and belonging, we actually talk about religions and moral codes and ideologies, because that's the easiest way that we know of, because these are the frameworks we use to hold our groups together.
Yeah.
And so they help us justify what we're talking about,
yeah,
why we're fighting. So to come back to your politician, just the same as people who are fighting, they're motivated as well by status and belonging. More leaders, I think, are motivated more by status than by belonging. And they then seek to justify those urges, which they do in the same way that we all do. And they talk about, you know, look at any politician when they're sort of, you know, advocating for war, they'll talk about it being right or justified or legal or
humanitarian.
You know, values, we're defending our values, or it's against, you know, the horrible, I don't know, jihadist ideology. And, you know, there's a small number of descriptions of motivations that politicians use when they're talking about war. And I argue that they're all post facto rationalizations of these intuitive urges.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, none of them get up there and say, I just have this overwhelming desire to fight them. it'd be interesting if someone did that in the cabinet.
So you went to Afghanistan. How did you feel before you went? Did you feel excited? Did you feel drawn to it? Did you feel motivated?
Well, we've certainly turned the cards on the podcast here, listeners. I very rarely answer a question on the show, but it's interesting having someone who was done a history degree and a fair bit of politics into that. I can honestly say that the reason for going was because at my point in my career at that time, it was time for me to go somewhere, and also it was a great opportunity to experience war. And then when I got there. It wasn't so much about the politics as it was about my role within that. And as a gunner, everyone knows that we lend dignity to what would otherwise be an ugly brawl. So it was about lending dignity to what the infantry and cavalry were trying to do. The reason I find this topic so interesting is that, you know, it also hits, strikes a bit of a personal chord as well for those of us that have been to some of these places. Because having done a lot of study post my tour as well, you know, I'd love to stand up and say it's always about liberal democracy, but for the individual, it's really hard to drive social reform in Helmand Province if you are responsible for dropping bombs on them, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a bit like anything by Spike Milligan and his role in defeating the Nazis. A small cog in what is a very large machine, and the motivations, I guess, for the individual relate to the small cog.
I think there was a lot of cognitive dissonance going on in Helmand when we, you know, just like you've spoken about, we're trying to bomb them into democracy. I mean, standing back now, it seems utterly ridiculous, but then it all made sense, because that's the way our brains work. They're able to hold dissonant ideas in our head together, you know, are able to hold these ideas that just seem ridiculous. And the reason you're able to hold ridiculous ideas in your head at the same time is because if you belong to a very strong social group, an army, you know, it's very well bonded, what you do within that group is you just accept the thoughts and ideas that are going around in that group, even if they're totally dissonant, because everyone else in your group believes them. So it's like groupthink, basically.
Yeah.
But that's particularly strong when you have really well-bonded groups. And that's what happens, I would argue, to you and to me and to all the other people who serve there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, someone asks for a well and you build them a school for their daughters. but to be honest, I actually did meet some people that did ask us to build school for their daughters.
Which was good, because that's what you were going to build them.
Yeah, which that's right. You're like, you have picked the right hand. In the other hand was like, you know, it was just another well. And that's not to make light. I know I have a lot of listeners that have been there, like myself and Mike, and have done some good work over there. But it's about the motivations whilst you were there, and how that links to your biology. Look, we could talk about this all night for you, Mike, and all day for me, but we've got to get to the final question because it's why listeners tune in, that and my jokes. So each guest gets to answer a sentence. It's kind of like the butcher's bill for coming on the show and me driving up their book sales rapidly after each episode's released. But there's a little caveat to that. That may not actually occur. So the mission of the Dead Prussian podcast is very similar to that of Big Carl. And you mentioned Big Carl and his unifying theory. I love one of his definitions of war, which was war is an inherently human interaction. But our understanding of war is framed by how we define it. And we've had a very different view on the show from you compared to a lot of our staple you know, all the historians that and strategists we have. So this is really great. Not cool. To discount your oral history work, you still count as a historian in my part, but I have to invite you to offer a definition and engage in this debate, or at least the framing of it. So can you please finish the sentence, war is?
War is intuitive.
Ooh, that's perfect for a 140 error tweet from Twitter. Now in the 280 error, it will look downright minimalist, and people will be like, "That is fashionable." War is intuitive. I love that that explanation.
I can give you a 280 character version if you want.
I've learned not to ask British academics to elaborate.
yeah.
Because sometimes it ends up them just explaining to me why it should be called the Second World War rather than World War II. So, look, Mike, thank you very much for coming on the show and providing us with a unique perspective on this topic. For our listeners out there, you can buy Mike's book. That's how you can support him. You can go to the show notes we've got on any of your podcast apps, or just go to our website, www.thedeadprussian.com, and go to the episodes page, and you can click the notes, and you'll find Mike's book, Why We Fight. And if you go through a book depository, the show gets a bit of a kickback. That's right. Let us steal Mike's money. And you can get it anywhere in the world because they offer free global shipping to anywhere on the globe. And I know a couple of listeners have struggled with what that actually means. It means if you buy the book on the internet from this website, the book will turn up at your doorstep, which is quite cool because, you know, lots of people who read books are very, very lazy. Now, thank you also to our Patreon members, those people who subscribe to the paid episodes, the bonus episodes, the book club. Your support is absolutely amazing. The transcript production is coming along. Once we hit our fundraising goal, we will be able to release our transcripts to everyone, although our guests will soon be getting their copy of their transcripts because I want them to have a copy of their own words when I call them into question. But until next time, listeners, grab a book and crack on.
Join the conversation with us on Twitter at Dead Prussian Pod, on Facebook at The Dead Prussian page, or on our website www.thedeadprussian.com. All show notes for this episode, as well as copyright information, can be found on the website. The Dead Prussian podcast is written, produced and hosted by Mick Cook. It is co-produced by Amanda Levito. The music used throughout is Caught in the Beat by Broke for Free and is used under a Creative Commons attribution license. All opinions expressed by individuals on the podcast are those of the individual and not necessarily representative of any other organisation.